Coming up on this week's episode of Check Your Balances are examples of a couple things that are legal, but maybe they shouldn't be. Stick around. That's coming up next.
Check Your Balances is a show produced and owned by Craftwork Capital. The views expressed by the hosts and their guests are personal opinions and should not be considered personal financial advice or the opinion of Craftwork Capital. All investments have risk and may lose money. Consult with your financial advisor, tax preparer, or attorney prior to implementing anything discussed, and please do not use this show as the sole basis for financial decisions.
Welcome back to another week of Check Your Balances. I am Ross Anderson, joined as always by my friend and co-host, Dan Maseka. How are you, bud?
Hey, I'm doing all right. How are you doing?
I'm okay. I've been a little tuned up today, as you are aware of. You got to listen to me go off on one of our partners. I won't be more specific about who that is, but as normally a pretty even-tempered guy, I think you heard me get about as fired up as I get in a business situation earlier today.
Yeah, I found it pretty entertaining. We had a meeting that we all joined, and the people who called the meeting weren't there, so I left and decided to take a drive and get a coffee and join from my phone when it later happened about 15 minutes after the fact, and got to hear you basically unload, which was very amusing for me and clearly got you pretty worked up.
Yeah, it was something that was building, right? It was just kind of frustration, and I think when you... there's always an interesting, like, how do you release your frustration in a business setting, right? Like, and it was kind of stuff we were hoping we would work through, and it just doesn't seem to be getting better. It only gets worse. And that person that called the meeting then being late, I think, kind of tipped me over the edge and got the business end of my frustration. So that's fun for us, for us to have a good conversation around that. And it kind of relays into what we're talking about today, which is stuff that is allowed to happen and shouldn't be, right?
You shouldn't be able to berate your professional partners.
Am I the bad guy in this now?
For my purposes at the moment, well, right. Sure.
I'll take it. Yeah. So, you know, I think of this through a couple different lenses, and we're in what feels like one of the most regulated businesses that you could possibly be in. Like, Dan, do you get shivers when you hear rollover checklist?
Oh, yes.
Right.
Constantly. I mean, I was in a situation very recently where a client left an employer and told me that she was ready to move her old 401k over to me. And I'm like, hold on. Like, let's talk about why you might not want to do that, because I thought there were very real considerations there. And she's like, I just want to do it. Someone told me that's what I should do. And I put the brakes pretty hard on that process until we went through a very thorough review of the costs and benefits.
Yeah. I think we're unique in that, because I do think we care about those things. I think we care about preserving those opportunities for people. We've talked about them on this show before, but for folks that don't know what we're talking about, the pro rata rule, if you're doing backdoor Roth conversions, you can put that at risk if you inadvertently roll over an old 401k and stack that in nicely with your IRA assets. You can screw up a strategy, or you can lose bankruptcy protections, or you can lose access to super low cost funds, or you can lose all sorts of different benefits of having money in a 401k versus an IRA.
Yeah, age 55 access.
Age 55 access is huge. If you retire at 55 and separate from service after the age of 55, but before 59 and a half, you get access to a 401k. You don't really get the same access to your IRA. You do if you exercise 72T, and then it's a whole thing. Yeah, it's something you don't want to do. If you can avoid not losing that access, you can do it. But there's a lot of unscrupulous advisors in this world that tell people, hey, go ahead and roll that bad boy over, because I've got an annuity to sell you. I don't get paid unless you roll it over. So that's what I think you should do. And there's some truth to that for people that manage money, that if you're charging AUM fees, you're going to make money if they move it, and maybe not if they don't. And that just leads me down a path of, what are some of the other things in this world that people are poorly incentivized for? And I don't know. I want to try not to make this political, but the first one, the idea, the reason this came to my head is that the fact that Congress people that basically regulate our country are able to buy and sell individual stocks of whom they are functionally the regulators is wild to me. That's a wild thing to have happen.
And there are a lot of everyday people who work for private companies who are restricted on buying individual stocks because their employers have relationships, consulting or otherwise, with those other companies. So they need to either pre-clear every trade or are just outright restricted from purchasing companies like that. I've worked with many who fall into that camp, and they're kind of in the indexing camp or mutual fund camp because they're not allowed to make active choices like that.
Right. It doesn't mean they can't be investors. It just means they can't pick winners and losers when they have a direct ability to influence that. Yeah, the example that comes to my mind is patent office employees. So we used to work right next to the patent trade office in Alexandria, like right down the block from where headquarters was. And I've worked with folks that are patent people before. They can't buy anything even near a patent that they're currently supervising, like not even in the same industry, because, and this makes complete sense, if you are approving the patent for some pharmaceutical or some technology or some whatever is being approved, you can either know or have a direct instinct that is an informed instinct that that's either going to be very protectable and potentially a big business, or that it's a direct threat to somebody else's existing patent and threatens their market, right? So if you're reading patent applications as they come through and you develop some intuitive nature to read the tea leaves, it makes sense that you can't then go bet on those same horses that you are functionally picking as winners and losers through your work. That's not what they're trying to do, right? They're trying to intellectually enforce a patent rule, but it has knock-on effects for investors, and that is foreseen and disallowed. Why would people that work in Congress or other high-level regulators be able to bet on the things that they regulate?
And this is a very active discussion because I believe it's been brought up many times with the hope of changing that. Like, there have been very public beneficiaries of stock trading in Congress. If you're on Instagram at all or Twitter, I'm sure you've seen memes alluding to that fact.
Yeah. And here's where it gets a little more hairy is when you introduce a spouse, right? So we have trading rules internally. You and me, Dan, we have certain things that you're just generally by law not allowed to do. We have things that by our handbook, because we have a firm handbook of like what our internal rules and policies and procedures are, we have things that we have to follow there. That includes if we place an equity trade, we have to either participate with our clients, so we can place what's called a block trade and trade across everybody's account and include our own. And that means everybody gets the same pricing. We're not showing a preference to any one trade in an account. Or if we have to do something separate or outside of that, we do it at the very end of the day. We make sure that all client trades have been executed, that we're not front running, that we're not selling our stake and then dumping a bunch of the stock later in the day, pushing the price down potentially. Our book isn't that big. We're not really moving markets, but the potential is there. And so even for a firm our size, which is not a particularly large firm by financial services standards, there's all these rules. Why do those not exist? But if that same rule extended to spouses, to me, that's where it gets hairy. Is it's easy to say, Dan, you can't trade on this. It's less easy to say, well, what can your wife do? What can she see? What is she allowed to know? And there was a recent case where a guy got convicted of insider trading because he was overhearing his wife's BP calls and placing trades as a result of that. That's clearly illegal. That's probably hard to catch unless you're really winning and doing it repeatedly. And supposedly the wife didn't know. But I find some of that type of stuff to be really, really interesting on where these things intersect.
Yeah, that's true. Because then where does it stop and how do you enforce it, right? Like for us, there's a very pricey tool that we have to use that basically tracks every trade that we make and accounts that are related in our household, and it feeds them all into a single point and flags issues to us. Like, that seems like a very expensive and complicated fix if we're trying to use something like that to solve the issue of Congress people doing insider trading.
The alternative is somebody has to do it manually, right? Somebody would have to look at every single transaction quarterly and then compare. I'm our chief compliance officer. I would have to look at your personal accounts, track every single trade in every one of your accounts that you have access to, yours and your wife's if you have a power of attorney. And then I'd have to compare it against what we do across our entire book, look at our whole transaction register and try and figure out the timing. And like, that's a mess. So yes, we pay, what do we pay? Like $500 a month for that thing?
Yeah.
That sucks. That's the worst money we spend.
Agreed. Yeah. Hopefully it keeps us out of jail.
Correct. Yeah. I don't want to go to jail. So it's worth it in that lens, but that is the worst money we spend for that tracking mechanism. That's basically like, did you do a thing in your account on a day where it also happened for a client?
Right.
But whatever. I'm sure they're not listening. That's not the partner we yelled at today. Their tool is fine. It's just expensive and I don't like paying for it. It feels like just a tax. So let me give you one more example that I see on TV all the time. And this is just my impression of misaligned incentives. I don't think they're doing anything nefarious or anything illegal here. I think they are allowed to do this, but it tickles my brain as to why this is allowed. Credit reporting agencies. Experian, all the time on my television, talking about their Boost product. Experian Boost. You're trying to get your credit higher, call Experian, they can help.
I'm sure they can.
Experian is one of three major agencies that reports on credit. When you apply for a loan, they ping one or all of these credit reporting agencies, and they basically say, hey, what are the chances this person's going to pay us back? That's what their job is. Their function is to tell the lender, are you likely, based on the information that has to be made available, are you going to pay that person back? Why are they then offering a for-profit product to the consumer? What could they be doing for that money? Dan, does that bother you when you see those ads? Did that spike in your brain like it has for me, or am I just a weirdo?
I haven't seen those ads. I think I watch a lot of ad-free streaming, so that hasn't come to mind, but I'd be very curious.
Weird talks, but okay, Dan.
I'm half tempted to, I'm rolling in money with my ad-free streaming platforms.
Yeah.
I'm half tempted to sign up and see what it does, because I'm curious if it's like coaching, which would make sense. If it's like, hey, here's let's go through your report together. Did you see you have this collections account from hospital 20 years ago? You should pay that $50 and that'll help, or whatever it is. But if it's like magic cleanup Boost, sign up and like 20 points get added. Like,
yeah, you pay me Boost. All we need is to know that you wanted a higher credit score and a few of your dollars in our pocket, and we can take care of this for you.
You paid us, so clearly you're trustworthy enough to pay other people. Plus 30 for you. Congratulations.
I find this to be so upsetting, just as a concept, that that's allowed. And in theory, this exists in bond investing as well, right? I mean, that was kind of the point of The Big Short, is that companies are either going to go to S&P or Moody's.
Right.
And they're going to get a credit rating. And if they don't like the credit rating they just got on their bonds, they're going to fire Moody's and go to S&P or vice versa. And so there is some element of who is the customer here, the person requiring the rating or the person that is trying to be rated. And that is a very ugly gray area to me. Because if your premise is that, well, we'll help you find the mistakes on your credit report and fix them, why the hell were you making mistakes to begin with? Isn't that what we're already counting on you to do, is to not make the mistakes? Is this just a service for people that are unwilling or unable to look at their own credit report and initiate a dispute or to initiate a review filing? Are you just paying them to show you how to initiate your own dispute of a piece of your credit history? Or is there something else that they're actually doing for you here? Because this strikes me as just nuts.
It is nuts. I think we need to get to the bottom of this. I would love to hear from someone who has been through this service. And I'm telling you, depending on the cost, I'm half tempted to do it just as an experiment and see what happens. Because it is a really interesting example of something that seems fishy to me.
Yeah, because when you look at a service like Credit Karma, which is now owned by Intuit, that is now the replacement for Intuit's Mint product. Rest in peace, Mint. We miss you.
We do.
But Credit Karma, I at least understand their incentives. They're going to help you get a handle on your credit because what they're trying to do is sell you a credit card. They're trying to tell you, these are the cards that you qualify for. This might be better than your current one. It might have a big bonus right now. They get money when you sign up for that credit card. I understand the business that they're in, which is we're going to help you with your credit because we want to sell you a credit card. What am I paying Experian directly for? And I'm not trying to single them out. I think the other reporting bureaus have a similar product to this. So again, I'm not trying to get sued by them. I just, in my mind, I find it boggling that they're on both sides of this transaction of trying to create accuracy and trustworthiness for the institutions that are actually trying to evaluate you as a lender. And then on the other side, turning themselves into a consumer product. That's wild to me. If somebody out there is listening to this and works for them, we would invite you on our show to tell us what we're missing here. Because we're clearly approaching this from a lens of curiosity and what could be happening here. This is not an accusation of any impropriety. Let's assume that everything is going well at these companies and is on the up and up. But it seems like that shouldn't be legal to represent both of those people at the same time. That seems like a lawyer that is both your defense counsel and your prosecutor at the same time.
I think part of the scenario you've described with both the credit rating agencies and the credit report bureaus is we have a very small pool of players that everyone relies on. I think that's first part of the problem. In the interim, I've gone to the Experian website to look at the Boost product. Have you done this yet?
I haven't actually.
All right. So how it works, three simple steps, Ross. Number one, you connect your bank account. Number two, you sure do. You connect the bills that you want to use, and they use those bills now to register like timely payments and tie that to your credit score as well.
Oh.
Interesting.
So this is for people that otherwise don't have actual credit. They don't have a lending history that's otherwise on record, and they're letting you pay to create one.
Yes, which I actually think is an interesting take.
Yeah, that you know what that reminds me of is these firms that are supposedly giving you like points for paying your rent. Like, because most of the time you can't pay rent on like a credit card, but there's supposedly some company now that lets you get points for paying rent through them, which, I mean, again, I don't know. Maybe that's just an advertising platform in disguise. If I prove that I've got $2,500 this month, some company wants to advertise to me, so they're willing to give me a deal.
Yeah. I can't tell if this costs anything. I suspect it doesn't, but then you get the Credit Karma deal too. Is they're going to start hitting you with advertisements from there?
Yeah, all of this, anytime I see somebody doing something, I'm curious what their motivations are. And I believe most business has a cost to it, and I'm mostly uncomfortable when people try to pass things off to me as zero cost. I'd rather know what I'm paying than have it baked into your incentive structure and not get it. If I don't get it, I'm upset by it.
Which one of the brokers, we used to work with a broker who charged for trades. It was very little, but they charged for trades notoriously at a time where everyone else was going to $0 trades. And that was their whole point. It's like, if you're not paying anything, you have to wonder why. And they're like, we're charging you because it costs money to run our platform. We're charging you a little because our platform is very bare bones. Yeah. Needless to say.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can say the name of that firm. That's not like proprietary sure. information. That was Interactive Brokers, which is who our old firm's platform was on. Yeah, it was. And we've tried to find a way to cover this several times. This has come up in our thoughts as payment for order flow.
Yeah.
I don't know that we've come up with a way to do a show on payment for order flow that is not just a paint drying sort of episode. But yeah, I think that's in the category of what we're talking about. Things where it's not illegal, but it should be at least more transparent. Like there's a form that every broker has to file for how much they pay or receive actually for their order flow. Is it like a 990?
It's not. I think that's a different form, but I know it's, yeah, there it's is a form.
It's like a 900 number reporting form.
Yeah.
And like the last time I looked at this, when I first tried to build a case, Robinhood, for example, was receiving like multiples of what Schwab or Fidelity were receiving for routing their trades to, you know, Citadel and you know, Knight Capital and some of these very specific places that buy that flow information so that they can trade against it. We haven't really talked that much about that topic since 2020 with all the GameStop, you know, saga unwinding, but that's really what was going on, is that certain firms sell that data versus do they execute the trades in-house? I don't know. We're having a very wandering discussion. This is probably closer to like a real podcast than me and Dan hopping on here and just making a point and trying to educate you. This is literally us thinking out loud about some of this stuff and trying to go somewhere useful. But these are all things that we think about that maybe shouldn't happen this way.
That's right. Yeah, I think those were the two big ones. Staying on the Experian website, I thought also it was interesting, speaking of understanding incentives, they have a FAQ section, and nowhere does it say, does this cost me anything? That's I found that interesting, especially because of the way it's advertised. Granted, I haven't seen the advertisement, but it looks like a product they're pitching you on. Like
step one, connect your bank account.
Yeah, step one. Yeah. Tell me everything about yourself and your money.
We'd like to know about your bank.
Yeah. Your information remains private. It tells you right there. So clearly that's my concerns have been alleviated.
I mean, this is a company that has all of the data about you, by the way. Once you have a credit report, they know it all. So let's not act like they don't have this data.
You find out right away if your FICO score has increased and by how many points. It's magic. It's beautiful. Millions of points boosted nationwide. 4 points have been boosted in Utah as I've been speaking.
It just happened. You did it, Dean.
Oh, it's great.
We'd love to hear from you all. What are you experiencing out in the world, whether it's a financial product or just something you deal with day to day, where technically it's legal, but you look at it and go, it really shouldn't be. I'd love to hear from you. We do have a mailbag episode coming up shortly here. So whether it's related to that or your questions about personal finance, something you think a couple certified financial planners might be able to help you with, check your balances at outlook.com is the email address for our show. Dan, anything to close with?
No, we appreciate all of you listening. We love hearing from you at Check Your Balances on Instagram. We have a YouTube page if you want to see us. And otherwise, we look forward to chatting with you every week, Wednesday mornings.
Dog kickers to the front. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll catch you next week.